and the judges of the Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals. Hear ye, hear ye. All persons having business before the Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals, draw near, for the court is now in session. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Please be seated. Mr. Eisenberg, I understand you're reserving 5 minutes, is that correct?
Yes, ma'am.
All right, good morning.
Morning.
Good morning.
Good morning,
ma'am. Are we ready to proceed in the case?
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am.
We'll hear the case of Airman Basic Sanchez del Carpio. Mr. Eisenberg?
Your Honors, may I sit please the court. My client has been denied his constitutional rights to a fair trial. He was denied due process when he was unable to cross-examine his witness or his accusers, in this case, during sentencing process. He was denied his constitutional right not to have to defend his Sixth Amendment right to make a defense in his case before the panel. He was denied his constitutional right not to have more than one charge against him when actually they should have been separate given the time, the manner, the time difference, and the type of crimes that were committed, even though they were two rape crimes.
Well, what constitutional right are you talking about that says he has a right to only be tried by one charge at a time?
Well, I'm referring back, if you will, specifically to Rule 413. Because in Rule 413, I understand that if you look at the rule in of itself, where the rule says the rule shall not be construed and to limit the admission or consideration of evidence under any other rule, when bringing forth two sex crimes, as we have two rapes here, we need to look at this in the context of the note in the end of our MCM, where specifically there needs to be a role of 403. This was clearly intended by Congress when this rule was being formulated. I mean, when you have someone like Senator Bob Dole come forth and say that to exclude evidence whose probative value is substantially outweighed by its potential effect, the general standards of the rules of evidence will continue to apply, including the restrictions on hearsay evidence and the court's authority under evidence rule 403 to exclude evidence whose probative value is substantially outweighed by its prejudicial effect. Here, we still need to look at a 403 balancing test when we bring forth these two trials, or when these two charges,
I'm confused. You're talking about Rule 413, and in this case, the defense, when they lost the motion to sever,
yes,
requested that the judge not give the 413 instruction. So what are you saying to us today?
Today, in that point, I go back to one of my other arguments where there was ineffective assistance of counsel, where there are certain rights that can't simply be waived. That makes plain error an obvious, makes it plain error quite obvious. The mistake was made. It denied him his constitutional right to a fair trial, and there was a prejudicial effect. When you have two charges, although be the same charge of rape, but they have completely different proximity in time. They were over a year apart. The frequency was only two, but it wasn't continuous rapes. They weren't the same types of rape. One was an acquaintance rape, and then was a stranger rape. One was involved a breaking and entering. The other one happened in his room under questionable events. Both situations, the victims in question, their testimony was questionable.
Wouldn't you agree that, I mean, at least one of the issues that you're making argument before us today is whether or not the judge screwed up and not severing the offenses. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, and what rule is it that governs whether or not the judge should have severed the offenses?
I understand that the court, and forgive me, I just recall the rule off the top of my head, but I understand that this court gives great deference to a military judge making his or her decisions at court But I believe it is the plain error rule. If I'm mistaken, please correct me.
Well, I think it's abuse of discretion. That's the standard. But, I mean, doesn't the judge look to make a determination whether or not by not serving the offenses there would be manifest injustice?
I apologize. Could you please repeat that?
Wouldn't the judge, in making the determination whether to sever the offenses, look to determine that if he would not sever the offenses, manifest injustice would occur?
Yes, he would, and okay. I dare say that he made great error in this situation.
And isn't there like a three-part test that the judge or court should use in determining whether or not there's manifest injustice?
Yes, there is, and I apologize. I just don't recall that test off the top of my head. I don't have it with me in my notes.
But, I mean, that is what we're here to talk about today, right? At least one of the issues is whether or not the judge screwed up by denying the motion to sever.
Yes. And I guess originally I was looking at the uncharged misconduct test, which I don't think is relevant after our discussion here now. But
I'll give you the third part. It's a three-part test.
Yes,
and I am interested in the third part. Mm-hmm. Talks about whether the findings reflect an impermissible crossover. And I'd like your input to us. Where was that impermissible crossover in this case?
Well, here we are telegraphing to the panel to begin with that the man is a serial rapist. And I understand that there are times when you can, under Rule 413, bring in various sex crimes to show, to help prove your case, if you will, or show a pattern. But in this situation, you can't, because the crimes in themselves are so different. Again, I go back to an acquaintance rape and a stranger rape. The means and methods that they were accomplished are completely different. The backdrop of the fact that the victim's testimony was in of themselves separately questionable. And you can't just combine a bunch of possibilities and hope that something will eventually stick in the end. That's not fair to my client in general. It sends a very chilling message, I dare say, to the members in service today, because they're not going to get a fair trial. They'll just think that the military justice system will just gang up on them and throw every possible charge against them in order to convict them. And quite frankly, it also sends a chilling message to the civilian world.
Did the judge give a limiting instruction in this particular case?
Yes, he did. But I don't believe, yes, he did in the very beginning. But even so, the bell has been rung. It can't be unrung in this situation.
I would say, and it's one of the questions that I am looking forward to ask appellate government, but I would say that you make a very persuasive argument that the first element of the three-part test, that this would be proven in your client's behalf as far as manifest injustice. But what I would like to know, given the limiting instructions and the way that the judge had the trial bifurcated as far as presentation of the evidence and the argument, where was the impermissible spillover? I want to talk about this third element of the three-part test. Where was the spillover?
The spillover was the whole trial in itself. You can't just convict, you still can't try one person for two charges in the same trial and not inherently have spillover.
Aren't members presumed to follow the judge's instructions?
Members are presumed to follow the judge.
So if the judge instructs the members that you cannot use evidence of this particular rape to prove that your client committed a rape against someone else, aren't members presumed to follow that instruction?
Members are presumed to follow that instruction, but we still can't say to their subconscious, because that thread will be from the start to the end of the whole trial, that this man is being defending himself for two different types of rapes.
So then it's your position then that in a situation like this, nothing short of severance would work to ensure that your client gets a fair trial. A limiting instruction would not work to minimize any prejudice that may occur by having the two offenses tried at one trial.
Yes, Your Honor, I have to agree with that statement. And if I may say that this case would be completely different if these were two different types of, if there were two stranger rapes or two acquaintance rapes, and the motive or the ways and means that these crimes had been committed were similar, then I say yes. You then have a serial rapist, and you could use one to bolster the other.
Well, I mean, I understand that. I mean, in essence, what you're talking about is the first prong of the three-prong test that we're talking about, you know, whether or not evidence from one offense could be used to prove the other offense. And we agree with your assessment that the two rapes were dissimilar, okay? But then that doesn't end the inquiry. You still have two other prongs. And, you know, the second prong that Judge Thompson was talking to you about was whether or not there was, well, I was talking to you about as well, whether or not there was a limiting instruction given.
And there was.
All right. And then the third prong was whether or not there are findings reflecting impermissible crossover. That's what Judge Thompson was talking to you about. And you said, yes, there was, because
the nature of the trial itself, the nature of the crimes at trial themselves.
I guess what I'm looking for is, where did it bleed into each other? Where were they so merged? Show me from the record where that happened, given that the judge had the parties bifurcate the presentation of the evidence and in the argument. So where is it that we can look to find this impermissible crossover?
There are no specific words. There is no specific testimony or summation throughout this trial. But you still have the dangling thread, common thread of rape. Rape, 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 rape.
I guess then I would take you to the granddaddy case of Southworth that gave us this three-part test. And when you look at the facts of Southworth, isn't it very similar to this? And in that case, we had two offenses. The military judge had the government do a compartmentalized presentation of the evidence. Argument had used two different theories, but it was separate, bifurcated portions of the argument. So isn't this case just like Southworth?
If I recall from Southworth correctly, the charges were actually similar in nature in which they were committed. This is, again, separate because these charges, in my client's case, are very different. Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't know. I thought Judge Johnson had something she wanted.
Well, actually, in Southworth, one of the things they talked about, that the two cases were very similar, but one was a child and the other was an adult, and that's where the court said these are two different cases, and so it seems to bring us right into the facts of your client's case.
I respect what you're saying. I still disagree as to the two types of cases. Still, they were rapes on an individual. Here, we still have two completely different types of rapes. I don't recall the age of the child in the case in question.
13. One was an adult, the other was 13. There were some similar things with both rapes, but that was where the court came down and said, These were two different cases, and so it seems very similar to your case. You have two different theories of rapes that your client is charged with.
But I dare say with a 13-year-old, it's still rather questionable, because a 13-year-old compared to a 6-year-old, I think there's a great difference. A 13-year-old compared to a 16-year-old, perhaps not. A 13-year-old compared to even an 18-year-old, perhaps not. We don't know what that individual looks like. We didn't know how much she had matured or blossomed and could simply pass off as a young adult. There are plenty of young adults who look 13, and there are plenty of 13-year-olds who look the age of consent. So unless we're prepared to delve that far deep into the case, I still argue that my case is very distinguishable from Southworth.
Okay, thank you.
I'm sorry, I don't know if there was another question or if you wanted me to speak, but if we can also look at the other issue of my client having to defend his Sixth Amendment right to defend himself in good faith, I dare say that the prosecution overreached in his summation. And actually, from two quotes that I highlighted in my brief, the first being, let me get there real quick. You heard about the process she had to go through to get here. Investigations, interviews, testimony, officers, senior enlisted, asking personnel, private information, complete strangers, and she had to continue through that process to the end. And it was a difficult one for her, and you saw her on the stand on Saturday, and you saw that. She was crying. She was stuttering. She couldn't breathe. Appellant needs time to consider the pain that he caused her and is causing the senior airman. I would dare say that if the overall effects that the trial had on her would probably be something that we couldn't appeal, that prosecution had the right to bring forward that as was witnessed on the stand during the trial. However, when in the two quotes I gave you, he ties it to the process that my client has the constitutional right to elect. That's where he crossed the line.
Well, I would like to ask you about the recent CAF case, U.S. v. Stevens, where they talk about that, and one of the distinctions they made is the comments refer to constitutional exercise of rights. And I don't see that in this section of argument that you have referred us to. I don't see any reference to an argument about his constitutional rights.
Well, if I recall correctly, when the case... I referred to, in the case, U.S. v. Hardison, that set out sort of a test stating that, one, the evidence being discussed must directly relate to the offenses of which the accused has been found guilty. And but the rule does not authorize introduction in general of evidence of uncharged misconduct in a higher standing than mere relevance. The second point is the second prong of that test must also pass the test of the Balancing Act of 403. Here, there's no probative value in the prosecution linking the testimony, if you will, to my client's right to a constitutional right to bring forth a defense and confront his accusers.
Where's the linkage?
I believe it was quite clear in the sentences that I had referred from my brief that I re-articulated before you a moment ago, where, if I may specifically quote the words I'm thinking of, and she had to continue through that process to the end. And the other, and is causing, currently causing, going through the process of him defending himself. Those are the links that I'm referring to. And regardless of how grand or how small the comments may be in the whole context of the prosecution's sentencing, which I believe was about 12 pages, and these comments encompass a half a page to a page, it's still too great of a weight given the right that we're talking about.
There was no objection by trial defense counsel, was there?
No, there was not. And
isn't, wouldn't you agree then that a lack of an objection by trial defense counsel is at least some measure of the fact that there's little prejudice, if any?
Normally, in a situation like that, I would say yes, except when you're dealing with a constitutional right.
But I guess I want to take you back to this recent CAF decision mm-hmm. in Stevens, where they focused in on comments very similar to what was made by the assistant trial counsel in this case, and they noted that what makes it objectionable is when the trial counsel starts talking about these constitutional rights. And I don't see that in the section of argument that you've highlighted for us.
I believe it's quite clearly inferred. And if there's any questions, then I dare say we need to send that back for a completely new trial.
Piggybacking on Judge Thompson's case, the Stevens case, it wasn't even inferred. It was more blatant in that case, and CAF upheld it as being appropriate comment, correct?
Yes, ma'am. Yes, Your Honor. But I dare say the risk is too high.
So you're saying CAF is wrong?
I'm saying that when it comes to constitutional issues, we can't shy away from them. We need to make
sure. So you want us to overrule CAF, basically, is what you're asking us
to
do.
No, ultimately I'm asking you to follow. Ultimately what I'm asking you to do is I'm not asking you to overrule CAF. I'm asking you to follow the Constitution. And the Constitution, I believe, trumps CAF.
Okay, but the only way we're going to be able to do that according to you, is to overrule the CAF case that just came out.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
And in your brief, you reference two opinions, Carr and Burns.
Yes, ma'am.
CAF specifically addressed in the Stevens case. So
we've made, you know, the CAF court basically acknowledges in a sense that it made some error in its prior cases that you just referenced to and redeveloped, if you will, the case law which we're supposed to follow, and perhaps it still needs a little more refinement. But if we go back, if we may, if we go back to the sentencing procedure, there is no doubt, if you look at Rule RCM 1000B4, there are many factors that the prosecution is allowed to bring forth, including psychological impact. But nowhere in the rules or in the notes do I see that the prosecutor is allowed to violate my client's constitutional rights.
Well, that's assuming that there's a linkage, which is what at least I'm struggling with. If there's no linkage, why wouldn't this be a proper matter of aggravation?
Yeah. Then I dare say it may be, but I don't believe that's the situation here. I believe there is a linkage there, and we're asking a panel, if you will, to try to delve into the mind, a three-member panel, to delve into the minds of the panel then. And if that bell had been rung, my client might have faced more punitive sentencing than he had to be set forth.
I want to ask you about the affidavit that the trial defense counsel submitted in this case in respect to the ineffective assistance of counsel. But in there, he comments that he made a tactical decision with respect to this one section that you're talking about, this one victim. He made a tactical decision not to object because he thought the fact that this person went through two separate investigations, mm-hmm. gave contradictory statements, might weigh with the members as they when they went back. And so shouldn't we give some deference to this tactical decision that trial defense counsel made?
But I believe in the case law that I've been referring to, IAC, if you will, can't be deferred on a constitutional issue. I think I'm referring to Burns off the top of my head, which I know is a civilian case, but I do think it causes us some pause to at least reflect on what it's trying to say. I understand that, you know, tactical errors in of themselves can't necessarily be questioned, but when it comes to constitutional issues, and if the counsel has fallen short, then I don't think there is any question that we need to discuss it today, and that it would hold precedence over what the trial counsel has said in his affidavit. Even if it was trial tactics, he can't err in such a degree that he violates anyone's constitutional rights.
What's the standard on review? I mean, obviously, is it plain error? Is it?
Actually, I believe, and I was wrestling this with myself earlier, I believe the error isn't plain error. I believe the bar is a lot lower when dealing with constitutionally grounded.
Okay, and what is that standard? Must there be a showing of prejudice? Substantial prejudice?
Actually, I believe it's beyond a reasonable doubt to show that there was prejudice. And I think we can show beyond a reasonable doubt here that my client possibly was exposed to a greater sentence than he had to be.
When you say possibly, isn't that pure speculation? Possibly sounds like speculation to me.
Well, then I'll dare say that I think 18 years were too long. Because, you know, I believe, if I recall in my earlier briefs, that we have found some cases where individuals convicted of two rapes served less time than my client. Further, we have very weak evidence in both cases. From both cases, there was no physical evidence. In both cases, there were questionable testimonies by both victims. Both victims had personal gain out of this. One was a jilted lover. The other one had, if I recall correctly, had to explain some other love paramour involvement with a love triangle, if you will. And here, I dare say that in the backdrop of everything, these two cases should have been severed. And I apologize. I think I mingled the two arguments that we have before us. So I apologize. But regardless, the court martial should not be allowed to profit directly or indirectly by arguments on finding a sentence, regarding an exercise of a constitutionally protected criminal due process right, as referred to in Carr, referencing U.S. versus Clifton, excuse me. Is there any other questions I can answer for the honors? Obviously I'm out of time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Murkowski?
Yes, ma'am. May it please the court. I am Captain Michael Rakowski, and along with Colonel Douglas Cordova, we represent the United States in this case. The military judge did not abuse his discretion when he denied appellant's motion to sever because, in this case, the two specifications were sufficiently dissimilar, the appellant raised a different defense to each specification, and there was proper procedures enacted to prevent any possible spillover. Moreover, the trial counsel's sentencing argument was appropriate as it was accurate comment on victim impact evidence in the record before the members and was not an express comment on appellant's constitutional rights. Moving first to the motion to sever, it's the general rule in the military that all known offenses be tried together, absent showing that doing so would create manifest injustice to the accused. In this case, for the appellant to succeed on appeal, he must be able to show that he suffered actual prejudice from the joinder of these offenses, not simply that he had a better chance of acquittal if they'd been tried separately. The government respectfully contends that in this case he cannot show prejudice because under operation of Military Rule 413, the evidence of each specification would have been admissible into separate trials of each offense.
Okay. Well, go ahead.
Well, this gets me back to the question that you had highlighted I was going to ask you.
Yes, sir.
In the three-part test, the first one talks about could evidence of one be used to the other? And in this case, as the defense has argued, this was a case where there were two separate offenses and two evidence wouldn't have been used to each other. So it would seem that the first part of the three-part test would be met in this case.
Well, Your Honor, we would respectfully feel that it would be admissible under Military Rule of Evidence 413, where it does allow this specific propensity evidence when you have another allegation of sexual assault. In this case, the government did petition a 413 instruction to the military judge prior to trial, but as his ruling on the severance motion, he agreed with a defense request not to give that 413 motion if he did not sever the case. I would specifically refer to, and this wasn't cited in our brief, but United States v. Jones. It's a recent decision from CAF. It's 63 MJ 217. In that case, they said there is no temporal limitation on using a latter event to prove a prior event when it comes to 413 and 414. So in this case, we would argue it specifically would be admissible, even using the second rape to prove the first one under 413.
Despite the fact that the military judge decided not to give the 413 instruction in this case in response to the defense three requests that they made after he denied their motion to sever.
Yeah, so, yes, Your Honor. And that's because he was denying the motion to sever. Our argument is if they had severed the charges, then it would be admissible under 413, thereby negating any possible prejudice the accused suffered from the joinder of the two offenses. Moreover, even if it wasn't, just for argument's sake, under Duncan and Giles, our Superior Court stated that when the judge takes appropriate remedial actions and limiting instructions, he negates the prejudicial effect of spillover in the case. So even if for some reason it wasn't admissible in the others, based on the proper procedures the military judge took in this case, he negated any possible prejudice to the accused. And those procedures were the ones that you outlined based on the defense's request. He bifurcated the presentation of the evidence and the argument. He decided not to give the 413 instruction, and he gave detailed limiting instructions both in voir dire before they heard evidence and findings after they heard evidence. Additionally, the counsel in this case actively pursued this bifurcation and actively mentioned the separation of the two crimes. Between trial counsel's arguments and the military judge's instructions, these members heard seven times they cannot use the proof of the two offenses with each other. They must separate them and find them separately. Turning to the impermissible crossover factor, the government would argue that since there was strong evidence of each specification, there was no impermissible crossover. And that's based on Curtis and Southforth, as this court has stated. We had four witnesses on the first specification. In the second specification, we had a taped confession from the accused. As such, we feel there's strong evidence on each specification and no stronger case running over into a weaker case. Simply because there is more than one victim of sexual assault is not grounds for finding the military judge abused his discretion. Under Southforth, as mentioned by this court, Simpson and Duncan, our superior court has stated that simply because there are multiple victims does not mean the military judge must sever the case. Specifically in Duncan, the accused even wanted to invoke his right against self-incrimination with one victim and testify to the others, and the judge denied that motion to sever, and our superior court in Capps said it was still appropriate to deny that motion. As such, based on the facts in this case and the law, there's no argument that the military judge abused his discretion.
Let me ask you, the appellate defense brief talked about the point that this, by having the two rapes together, that it was telegraphing to the members that this he was a serial rapist. And then when the military judge allowed testimony to come in with respect to the appellant going up to one of the witnesses and asking for a threesome, that this just sealed the deal for the telegraphing of this serial rapist for these members. Could you respond to that?
Yes, Your Honor. Turning specifically to the issue about the appellant requesting the threesome from a witness the very night of the first rape against Airman A.B., the military judge gave a very detailed findings of fact and conclusion of law on that issue. He found that for the non-propensity purposes of identity and motive, it was admissible at trial. Specifically, he found identity to be the stronger probative basis because the appellant was essentially challenging whether the victim could properly identify her attacker that night. She had seen him earlier that evening asking somebody for a threesome twice. She didn't know his name. She only knew him as the guy that was asking someone for a threesome. And then later that night, she wakes up and he's on top of her raping her. And that's how she identified him to her friend the next day, was the guy that asked you for a threesome. As such, it was appropriately admissible in this case. We would specifically highlight the judge offered to give a limiting instruction on that evidence to the members, and the defense counsel declined it. So to the extent that we're claiming that was inappropriate because of the prejudicial basis, that's one factor this court should consider, is the judge offered to limit that evidence and the defense decided not to highlight it any further to the members. I don't believe that simply trying two offenses together is impermissible unless it can meet the three-part test of Curtis and Southworth. And here we feel that the government wins on all three factors under Curtis and Southworth based on the detailed finds of fact and conclusions law and the proper procedures the military judge put into place in this case. If there's no further questions on that issue, I'll move to the second issue. A trial counsel may argue victim impact evidence in the record and reasonable inferences drawn from the record. As the court has already stated, our Superior Court in the United States v. Stevens has basically touched on whether this is appropriate victim impact evidence to begin with. In this case, the emotional impact of appellant's rapes on A.B. and K.K. was self-evident in the record. The government has cited several times in the case where both victims had considerable difficulty testifying about being raped by the accused. Both victims on the direct examination cried the first time they had to discuss being raped by the accused. These are all things that happen on direct examination, nothing that happened on cross-examination. And the first victim even had a difficulty where she had to take a break shortly into her testimony, and she began to experience a panic attack later on during her testimony.
But is this being brought on by the rapes or by the procedure?
Your Honor, we would argue brought on by the rapes. If this court looks at the actual questions being asked in this case, record 716 was the first time A.B. was asked about the rape. And as she had to describe being raped by the accused, she began to cry. Record 1160 is the second victim, KK, describing the rape, and she begins to cry as well. They're not crying based on cross-examination or a defense counsel being brutal to them or anything. It's actually with the trial counsel asking, just simply tell us what happened, and that's when they're having difficulty.
So this is probative to show victim impact?
Yes, Your Honor.
And the military judge didn't do a 403 balancing test, did he?
Your Honor, since there was no objection raised to it, there wouldn't have been a 403 balancing test on the record. So, of course, yes, there is no 403 balancing test there for that.
Well, didn't Caff and Stevens also caution trial counsel that this is an area where you could cross over an impermissible argument and hit on a constitutional right?
Certainly, Your Honor. Anytime we have something talking about a testimony, it's a area where you have to be careful. But we don't feel the trial counsel crossed any lines here.
But they specifically in the case said, while in Stevens they find no abuse of discretion, it's not difficult, particularly in cases involving sexual abuse, to envision such a case. Isn't that the kind of case we have right now?
I would respectfully disagree, Your Honor. Turning not only to Stevens but to Paxton, which was cited in our brief, that was another case where they cautioned counsel in the future from being careful as to what you say to make sure you're discussing the evidence in the record and not discussing the appellant's exercise of his rights. There, I believe there was a psychiatrist that testified for the defense that discussed some reoffender testing he had done on the accused and the fact that he wasn't fully forthcoming with the psychiatrist. Trial counsel in a sentencing argument then said he won't admit this to his doctor, he needs more help, he needs more time because he won't admit this. Our Superior Court specifically stated he was referring to the evidence in the record and not referring to the appellant's exercise of his constitutional rights. Again, they cautioned counsel, and it's important to caution counsel to make sure they understand where the line is. We don't feel that the trial counsel in this case stepped over that line because there was no express comment to his constitutional rights. There was no even discussion of the cross-examination or being forced to relive this or anything else that was in Carr and Burns. There was only proper reference to the victim impact evidence that was clearly evident in front of the members as they saw and as they heard.
What could the statement, "she had to continue through the process through the end," mean if it's not referring to the entire court-martial process?
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, based on Stevens, we don't feel that referring to the entire process is inappropriate. I believe the court specifically stated in Stevens that testimony as to the effect of the process, including the trial, on the victim certainly comes within the rather broad ambit of RCM 1001b4. So even if that's what it's referring to, we don't feel that's inappropriate. However, in this case, we feel that if you read the entire argument in its context, they're essentially talking about how difficult it's been on her. And even if he had pled guilty, she would have been testifying and sentencing, and it would still have the same emotional impact.
Well, we don't know that, though, right? I mean, obviously, if this statement refers to the fact that the appellant is putting the government through the test of, you know, proving his guilt, then that would be a comment on his constitutional right, wouldn't it?
If, you know, and the difficulty here, if you read the statement that way, we'd be arguing that you'd be reading something into it that when you read the entire context of the argument and the entire context of the case, that's not what it meant. Specifically in Paxton, our Superior Court stated you need to read the entire argument, read it in context to determine its feeling. There they stated the direction, the tone, and everything else in the argument wasn't the trial counsel specifically commenting on the accused exercise's rights. He was commenting on the evidence in the record. We would argue the same is true here.
Well, you cite Paxton, and I note that Stevens, and it was a point made by the appellate defense response brief, that Stevens dealt with witness testimony, and we're talking here about argument.
Correct, Your Honor.
So perhaps it's not the case to rely on when we're looking at argument and whether someone's constitutional rights have been violated by the argument.
And that's why we refer to Paxton, Your Honor, because that was a trial counsel's argument. It does not appear they've had a direct case on this issue at CAF, at least not that I found, as to commenting on the victim impact evidence in argument. But between Stevens saying this is appropriate evidence and Paxton saying read everything in context and no explicit reference to an accused constitutional right is appropriate argument, we would argue that based on the facts and the law, this was appropriate by the trial counsel. Turning just briefly to the ineffective assistance of counsel issue, even though it wasn't granted here, it was brought up. In Paxton, again, they stated since it was not plain error to make the argument, it was not ineffective assistance of counsel not to object to it. We would state the same thing here. Since the argument was appropriate, it's not ineffective for not objecting to it. Is there no further questions? May I briefly conclude?
Any other questions? You may. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. The military judge did not abuse his discretion in denying appellant's motion to sever based on the reasons set forth. Furthermore, the trial counsel's sentencing argument was appropriate comment on the evidence in the case, and there was no express reference to the appellant's constitutional rights or to his execution of his constitutional rights. As such, this court should affirm the findings and sentence in the appellant's case. Thank you.
Thank you, Captain McCaskill. Mr. Eisenberg?
I want to address, if I remember correctly, from Senior Judge Jackson, a comment about the context of what those two quotes I mentioned from the prosecution during sentencing. You asked me, well, isn't it, can you tell one way or the other what it was actually a linkage or not? We can't assume that the panel understood the context, the meaning of the prosecution's statements. How can we assume what he meant? And we don't know. We can't assume what the panel understood because we don't know. The appellee also made a comment about how Calf said that the temporal event issue isn't relevant. Well, it's contrary to the RCM and the notes therein, that temporal events, the timing of the events, do have some meaning involved with my client's case, especially given that they were over a year apart. This just didn't happen within a week or two or even a month, but a year apart, again, with the same backdrop of two very questionable witness or victims and two different types of acts that were my client was convicted of. Also, not to get into the facts and the legal sufficiency of the case, but the appellee also mentioned something about there was recorded testimony of my client basically admitting to the events involved. Well, that's also an issue of interpretation. From my perspective and others, it sounds like an individual who is remorseful that his friend felt hurt, possibly abused by another friend. I don't believe that was an actual admission of guilt. It was just an admission that he felt bad for her, regardless of what the situation may be. Remember, this is also a lover who had been spurned by my client and has every reason to be upset with him, has every reason to want to enact vengeance upon him.
So an acknowledgement on part of your client that the victim told him no and he continued to have sexual intercourse with her anyway, it's not an admission of guilt?
Not necessarily. I mean, I think we all want to comfort and console our friends, especially when we may have made a mistake. To what degree is another question. And when you're consoling a friend like in a moment like that, the last thing you really want to do is get into an argument.
So then in essence, he was just lying when he stated that, yeah, you said no, but...
I think he was just trying to make his friend feel better. Furthermore... part of the limiting instruction, if I recall correctly, from the government was about the identity that the two rape cases could be used to identify. Did I hear him correctly? And if I did hear him correctly, I don't understand how bringing forth two specifications of different rapes by different people in different manners helps prove identity.
I think it was with respect to the first rape, and it was the comment about threesome, and it was in that context of the testimony that came out with respect to threesome, and I believe that's what his point was.
And I'll defer, of course, but I think this brings us to a good point that government stated that seven times the panel heard about from the judge the no crossover allowance in this trial. Seven times. But how many times, and I dare say many, many more, did they hear rapist, or the threesome term, pervert, sexual deviant? There's got to be something wrong with this person. It's the same thread from start to finish that unfairly biased my client to having a fair trial. Again, you're constantly pounding home the same thing over and over again. Rapist, pervert, deviant. There's got to be something wrong with him, regardless of how strong the evidence is. And on the other argument we have today, if he has to serve even one more day than he should have had to, had that connection, had that link, as we argue, has been made, because the prosecution erred, the defense counsel erred, and the judge, the military judge, erred as well by not correcting the situation, quite frankly, calling a complete mistrial. Because we can't risk violating anyone's constitutional rights. And if this court wants to send that message to the members of the military, especially in the Air Force and other three branches, that we're going to rip shot over your constitutional rights, regardless of how minor, then that's a very chilling message to send. In conclusion, if I may, my client has been denied a fair trial. He was denied due process in the sentencing, which affected his whole trial. He was denied his constitutional right to raise a defense. He was denied his right not to have two charges against him when they should have been separated and bifurcated, as discussed in my two prior briefs. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson.
Thank you.
Thank you for those arguments. We will be issuing our opinion in due course. Court is adjourned. Thank you.
All rise.